Welcome to Walter Rogers Journal. With me in the studio today is Andrew Waters, who's from up at Clemson, where he's pursuing a graduate degree. And Andrew has written a book entitled The Quaker and the Gamecock, Nathanael Greene, Thomas Sumter, and the Revolutionary War for the Soul of South Carolina. Andrew, that's a fascinating title, and you know I love the subject of the revolution in the backcountry, so welcome to the journal.
Thank you so much, Walter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about, first of all, a little bit more about you. You are pursuing a graduate degree.
That's correct. I work full-time. I'm the executive director of the Spartanburg Area Conservancy, which is the nonprofit land conservancy in Spartanburg, South Carolina. A couple of years ago, I decided I wanted to pursue my graduate degree and started at Clemson in a program they have there called Policy Studies, but now I have transferred over to a program they have there called Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Management, which is known by PRTM. So I do that part-time in addition to my conservation work in Spartanburg.
Well, you've been working with conservation. What made you decide to turn towards history?
Well, I've always been interested in history, and I've always been interested in writing. I remember as a child playing in my family's living room, and my father's history books were up in the shelves, kind of looking down on me as I played. And I always felt like there was something in those books that I wanted to know about, that I wanted to discover. And of course, eventually, as I got older, I was able to read those books and start to learn about American history. In those days, it was primarily the Civil War that I was interested in. You know, as a young man, and I'd heard stories about the Civil War, people in my family participating in the Civil War. And it wasn't really until I moved to Spartanburg, South Carolina in 2013 until I started to become aware of the rich Revolutionary War history that was here in South Carolina. You know, I grew up in Hendersonville, North Carolina. That's where I was born and raised. And it was something of a revelation to me when I came to Spartanburg because I really had no idea that there was so much of this Revolutionary War history, really just down the road from where I'd grown up.
But of course, those folks from Western North Carolina and over the hills were part of the story as well.
Absolutely. And I did come to understand that. I think that doing conservation work up in the backcountry, you really start to understand, you know, how prevalent some of this activity was in this area when you start to learn about some of these sites associated with our Revolutionary War history, some of which have been conserved, protected, but many of which are still unprotected and just kind of out in the woods.
Well, we're hopeful that the American Battlefield Trust will continue its efforts, and some of those will come under conservation easements and protection, because we do have an incredible number of battle sites here in South Carolina from the Revolution.
There is does seem to be some renewed interest in focusing on this area for conservation of Revolutionary War sites, and as a conservationist, I'm very excited about that.
Well, especially in the backcountry, the battle sites are also in many cases scenic sites, natural scenic sites as well. You mentioned that you started reading history and focusing on the Civil War. Where did you do your undergraduate work?
I am a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. My undergraduate degree is in English. Oh. I'm a literature major, and that was really where I started to cultivate a love of writing that I just kind of carried on with as an avocation for these last 30 years.
So with an English major, how did you end up in Spartanburg with conservation?
Well, that is a very involved question. I'm not sure if we have enough time in this interview. But basically, I started off my career in the publishing field. I worked as an editor and a copy editor for about 10 years. And then I had a career transition And I ended up in the real estate industry. I was actually doing residential real estate sales. And there was a land conservancy in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Catawba Lands Conservancy. And they were looking for a real estate manager, someone to help manage their real estate transactions. And I applied for that job, and I got that job. It was really a life-changing moment for me, and I've been really had a rich and rewarding career in land conservation ever since.
That interest, of course, has then led you to pursue the doctoral program at Clemson.
Absolutely. I feel like at this point I have some knowledge and understanding of the industry, and I'd like to deepen that. And hopefully someday, in addition to doing more Revolutionary War writing, do some writing and research on land conservation.
What made you decide to write your latest book?
There were really four different things going on, Walter. I feel like I've always been a bit of an outsider looking in to South Carolina. You know, growing up in Hendersonville, we would come down to South Carolina quite a bit. And I always felt like I was kind of peeking over the border into South Carolina and instinctively sensing some cultural differences between the two states, but not really knowing what those differences were. So in 2013, I moved to Spartanburg to take the position at Spartanburg Area Conservancy. And so then I was in a different position. I was inside of South Carolina, and now I was really trying to understand the culture here and what gave South Carolina the cultural identity that it has that I sensed as a child. As I started to read and learn more about the history of the area, I really came to this period of the American Revolution, where the culture here was really in turmoil and experiencing a civil war. I found a lot in that conflict that helped me understand the state. At the same time, I was taking a course in Clemson in political philosophy, political ethics, and in that course we were talking and learning about political ideologies, the difference between libertarianism and egalitarianism. At that time also, we were undergoing a presidential election. And all of these forces just kind of came together, and I started thinking about Nathaniel Greene as the outsider, kind of adopting his perspective in coming into South Carolina and trying to understand the landscape, the political landscape, the socioeconomic landscape that he was dealing with when he led the Continental Army into South Carolina in the spring of 1780. And that brought me to the Gamecock.
So why the Gamecock? Why not Francis Marion? Why not Andrew Pickens? Why not James Williams? Why not William Davey?
Well, I think it was the fiction writer in me, the writer in me, that just was drawn to kind of the personality conflict that was occurring between Nathaniel Greene and Thomas Sumter. I felt like that was really a kind of interesting dynamic to build a narrative around. As of course you know, Thomas Sumter had really emerged in 1780 as the leader of the South Carolina militia forces. And there really was no civil authority in South Carolina at that time beyond Thomas Sumter.
Andrew, to a point, because there were many other militia bands, he certainly was the most noted.
Point well taken, Walter. Yeah. He kind of emerged as the foil for the Gamecock as I was thinking about the outline for this book.
So the Gamecock becomes the foil for the Quaker.
Correct.
And I was curious about your title, and I know how you got it, but I want to explain it to our listeners, because titles are very important And this comes from your salesmanship experience, I'm sure. Now, Nathanael Greene had been reared a Quaker, but, you know, he had abandoned his faith by that time. So why the title?
Well, excellent question. The book really was built around the title. I like the way that those two words went together, the alliteration of those two words. And I do talk about that in the book, how by the time of what's going on in the book, Nathanael Greene had really left behind his Quaker faith. I make the point in the introduction to the book that the Christian humanist in the Gamecock just doesn't really have the same ring to it. But I do think that Greene's Quaker upbringing, where he was in a way, it was a very intellectual upbringing where he was really thinking deeply about religious issues and cultural issues, and his Quaker faith was really a part of that process of circumspection. And I do think that religious training kind of guided Greene as a Continental general.
Yeah. Well, I just think that the title selection in terms of marketing is brilliant, okay? As you said, the Christian humanist and the Gamecock just does not ring. And
yes,
you've got to have a grabber, and you've got one. Andrew, we need to pause for a moment,
okay,
let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Andrew Waters about his book, The Quaker and the Gamecock, and we're discussing the revolution in the backcountry. Let's talk about how you went about writing the book. When did you start working on The Quaker and the Gamecock?
Yeah, so I got to Spartanburg, and I'd been reading and reading and reading, including Partisans and Redcoats, which is referenced in the book and was a big influence on the book. And I found there's a really great website out there for folks like me that are interested in the American Revolution. It's called the Journal of the American Revolution. And I started doing some article writing for that website. Actually, two of the chapters in the book first appeared as articles on that website. They were received well there. The editor there, Don Haggist, has been a big influence on me, a great supporter of my writing work. And that really convinced me that maybe I could take this writing interest I have and put it into writing a book like this, a history of the American Revolution.
Okay. Let's just sort of set the narrative for our listeners. We do talk about the revolution a lot here, but since you're revolving around Greene and Sumter, we need to get Nathanael Greene to South Carolina.
Okay.
So let's back up a little bit, the fall of Charleston.
Correct.
And, of course, the Battle at the Waxhaws and Bloody Tarleton. But then we have a new Continental Army coming in. And Sumter plays a role in what happens to Gates and his Continental Army. So why don't we pick up the narrative there?
Okay. Well, so at the Battle of Camden, where Horatio Gates had just very recently come down and taken command of the Continental Army, Sumter had approached Gates and said, while you're attacking Camden, I will go behind the British lines and attack their supply lines and disrupt their supplies while you're attacking the British forces under Charles Cornwallis. So that's essentially what happened. Sumter did successfully attack some of the British supply trains. He captured quite a bit of supplies. But as you know, the battle at Camden was a disaster for the Continental forces.
It was. Horatio Gates, the hero of Saratoga, at least that's officially, although Benedict Arnold really, as military folks know, was the guy who really did it. But anyway, Gates was the hero. He was put in command of the Continentals in the South over Washington's objections. He was a political appointee, and he forced-marched his army towards Camden, and they were eating green corn and molasses, which is a natural purgative, which meant that the boys were had upset tummies running to the woods.
Wasn't a pleasant march
through the woods. Was not a pleasant march. And in many ways, Sumter kind of fed that idea to Gates. Come on, let's get this over, you know, attack Camden, let's get this quick. Sumter's impetuosity begins to show from the beginning the way he operated. And as you said, it was a disaster. Gates didn't stop running away on a horse until he got to Hillsborough. And so his troops had two names for him. One was Granny Gates, which was definitely bad, and the other was Galloper. And we focus on Camden and the disaster. And as you said, Sumter was successful in capturing supplies, freeing some prisoners. And there again, Sumter begins to show one of his weaknesses, and that is if he came across supplies, he just kind of stopped and enjoyed it. So I'll let you pick up the narrative for there.
Yes, sir. So in the wake of this disaster, Horatio Gates was essentially removed from command of the Continental forces in the South. And finally, George Washington was able to appoint his protege, Nathanael Greene, to this command. And Greene had been serving rather unhappily as the quartermaster general of the Continental Army, and he longed for an independent command, and Washington had tried to give him one but had been prohibited by Congress. But finally, Washington was able to give Greene this opportunity to command the Southern Army and the Southern Continental Army. So Greene comes down and finally takes command from Gates in early December of 1780. And something very significant had happened just about 12 days before that, and that was that Thomas Sumter, the Gamecock, was very seriously wounded at the Battle of Blackstocks, which is not far from my home in Spartanburg. Through this injury that Sumter received at that battle, he was largely incapacitated when Greene arrived. So there was a power dynamic shift that occurred because of Sumter's injury, because of that wound, that allowed Greene to kind of take command of not only the army but the militia forces in the upper part of South Carolina. Not to say the Gamecock was out because he was still very active, but he was down. And I think an incident from that period really kind of was the spark that ignited the narrative of the book. And that was that when Greene sent Daniel Morgan over to western South Carolina to forage and threaten Cornwallis's flanks, Morgan tried to collect supplies from some of the South Carolina militia that had been serving under Thomas Sumter. And essentially, the militia commander, William Hill, said, "We're not going to help you with these supplies unless the order comes directly from Thomas Sumter." So in that moment, it kind of became clear that there were going to be some issues of command between Greene and Sumter.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sorry to say, I think at times Sumter was very prickly and very conscious of his status and prerogatives, which down through history have not served him well. So we've got Cowpens, one of the great victories of the American Revolution, is still studied at Fort Leavenworth at the Commanding General Staff College. At this period, the one thing about Sumter that bothers me is, of course, Kings Mountain comes before that, and he's not there because he's I'm sorry. I think he's pretty petty about where do I stand? James Williams had been given a brigadier general commission by Governor Rutledge. Williams was an old soldier from 96th District. But because of this, who do I outrank? I'm not going to do him. Sumter is absent from Kings Mountain. And with a lot of backcountry folks, you know, he was from the Sumter area, but a lot of the backcountry folks never forgot that he wasn't there at a key moment.
Yes, I think one of the things that kind of intrigues me as a writer is that the Gamecock nickname is just such a perfect name for Sumpter, because he really did have this prickly personality.
Strut. He liked to strut.
Absolutely. But his soldiers loved him for it. They were drawn to his charisma.
You know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, Andrew. He was an incredible recruiter. I mean, he could lose a battle and everybody would be ticked off, but then he could go and raise more men. He was not a particularly good field commander. He was impetuous. His idea was, let's hit him head on and that's the way it's going to happen. It didn't always work that way. That's where Marion and Pickens were more successful, mm-hmm. particularly Marion, knowing that, hey, we are a guerrilla force, are a partisan force. We're not going to go head on. But anyway, I stopped your narrative. You were going there about the fact that Sumpter was able to rally folks because of his charisma, his personality.
Yes, and his lieutenants, the militia commanders that were allied with him, were very loyal to him. I think it's interesting. They talk a lot about how it was a very democratic process, this issue of leadership, and that, you know, he was essentially elected general of his militia.
Thanks to Richard Wynn, he maneuvered that he got himself up. Since you took political ethics, you can. And he, you know, he was without question a major figure,
yes,
in the Revolution. You've mentioned Black Stocks, which was a significant battle,
yes,
because the losing commander was Bannister Tarleton. It's the only incidence where regular Brits, British troops, fled a militia force. The bookend of that is Cowpens is the only time where regular British actually fled a field of battle during the Revolution. So those two important military, in terms of military tactics, happened right here in the Palmetto State.
Yes, and I am a big proponent of the idea that without Sumter's success at Black Stocks, that Morgan might not have been as successful at Cowpens, because at Black Stocks, first of all, there are many of the same men that were fighting at Black Stocks that were later fighting at Cowpens. And at Black Stocks, Sumter set up in a defensive position. Now, he was arrayed behind a log wall and some farm buildings. And in contrast, Morgan was arrayed out in an open field. But Sumter and his men understood that Tarleton, his primary mode of attack was the direct charge.
Well, see, that's where he and Sumter were very much alike in terms of
absolutely. And this, I believe, this is the only time that Sumter fought from a defensive position. I believe that's correct.
I'm pretty sure you are, but there are a lot about somebody's going to call in, I'm sure, and correct us on that one.
But this was a wildly successful engagement for Sumter. From this defensive position, they really were able to inflict quite a few casualties on Tarleton's forces. As you alluded to, Tarleton was kind of renowned, reviled in South Carolina as Bloody Ban, as kind of this evil, vindictive figure, and no one had really defeated him up to this point. And this was a major watershed in the campaign when Tarleton was defeated. And I have this theory that some of the soldiers at Black Stocks must have told Morgan that this is what Tarleton would do when he comes and attacks.
I hear your theory, and it's an interesting one. Although Tarleton's predilections were pretty well known. he was known for that kind of behavior,
right,
for the good old frontal assault, and those rabble will just disappear in front of the, particularly a British bayonet charge. Having the cavalry there certainly helped as well. But Sumter missed out on Cowpens, not because he didn't want to be there, but because he was seriously wounded and almost died after Blackstocks. He'd actually won the battle. And then he's looking, overlooking the battlefield, and there happens to be one small British unit there that starts firing, and he's shot. He's wounded about five places, I think.
Right? Apparently it was buckshot, and five pellets entered his body, one of them kind of crossing through his body and lodging into his shoulder. He's out on the field, and he realizes the blood is dropping from his body, and he tells his attendant, "I'm wounded," but he's trying not to let the men see that he's seriously hurt. So he goes, and they take him to the farmhouse, and they realize that he's very seriously injured, and they put him on a beef hide. They say, and carried him back to his base over in the new acquisition district. And the British were so obsessed with capturing or killing the Gamecock that Tarleton actually pursued Sumter for 2 days before he gave up on the pursuit, and Sumter got away.
Well, when you say he was on a beef hide, he basically was being carried on a litter.
Right.
He's got buckshot in him. Eventually, were the buckshot taken out before they started carrying him away, or
they? Yes, there was a surgeon there at Blackstocks.
But these pellets were removed without any kind of anesthesia. I mean, the bite, the bullet. I don't know if this anything is quite that dramatic, but the surgeon's digging with his knife into the man's flesh to extract the buckshot.
Yes, and in the book, I use that as a literary device. I kind of question, did he realize the significance of what he'd done or what his wound would mean to the campaign? I say no. He must have been barely conscious at all. He was very seriously injured at this time,
and his recovery was slow because of infection and everything else. I mean, he was sidelined for several months.
Absolutely. But one thing that I really find fascinating about Sumter is even though he was bedridden for several months and this wound continued to bother him really throughout the course of the period that's covered in this book, he was still the spymaster supreme of South Carolina. He had this vast intelligence network, espionage and counter-espionage. It was pretty sophisticated, and he was still able to run this espionage operation from his bed while he was wounded.
Well, what did he do with what he found out with the espionage?
Well, he was full of good advice, for one thing. He really was urging Greene to attack 96 in this period kind of leading up to Cowpens, and Greene kept saying, no, even though that outpost may be vulnerable, I don't want to risk the Flying Army, Morgan's troops, on an attack of this sort. But he was also, you know, he was passing some information along and keeping some to himself. He never stopped thinking about his own campaigning, his own military objectives throughout this time.
Well, see, I think that incident there about 96 is the difference between strategy that Greene thought of and Sumter thought of. Sumter's thinking, well, we've got to take this outpost. Greene's goal was you've got to keep your army intact. Greene may never have won a battle, but he won the war. And that's what's taught at Leavenworth. That's the difference. People say, well, why didn't he do this? Why didn't he do that? The main thing was keep his army together.
Absolutely. I think you might use the analogy that Sumter was the Gamecock was the football player as the emblem not too far away, looking down on us from the stadium not too far away. But Greene was really the chess player. He was thinking moves ahead.
Andrew, that's a brilliant comparison. And I think it reflects their personalities as well. Well, while Greene is trying to keep his army together after the race to the Dan and then back into South Carolina, and Cornwallis goes off saying he doesn't want any more adventures in South Carolina, there's still battles to be fought, Eutaw Springs. And in trying to keep his army together, Greene's not getting any money from Congress. They're not providing that. So there is a contractor who said he'll supply Greene's army, and Greene said, fine, I'll back up. I'll co-sign the note or whatever.
Correct.
And then that guy doesn't pay his bills.
Correct.
And even after his death, Greene and his estate are pursued by folks trying to collect the expenses of the Continental Army in the last 18 months of the war.
Yes, and this is really moving ahead in the narrative more towards the end of the book, but you're quite right. Greene had really taken on quite a bit of personal debt, or secured quite a bit of debt personally, in order to feed and clothe his troops. And at this point, this was after Eutaw Springs, and kind of the Continentals were surrounding Charleston, and there was just no other way for him to provide these things to his troops. So after the war, there's some assurances made that the federal government, the new federal body, would reimburse the soldiers for these type of expenses. But there's a lot of bureaucracy involved then as now, and he could not get this reimbursement. So
because we're really dealing with the Continental Congress, it's, you know, not the new federal government yet. It takes until we get a constitution before Greene's widow can get Congress to pass the necessary legislation so that the debts can be paid.
Quite right. Ultimately, these debts did get repaid, but tragically, Nathaniel Greene died just a few years after the war. He died when he was 43 years old, and I think that's a big reason why maybe his military legacy isn't as well known today, because he did die so young, and he never went on to kind of the political career that some of the other officers went on to.
In fact, he had actually – there was talk of him taking political office, and he turned that down.
Well, that's correct. One reason being that he didn't see a path towards being able to pay his debts through a political office. He was very concerned with making money and paying some of these debts that he'd incurred.
Well, after the war, South Carolina and Georgia both awarded him with large pieces of property.
That's correct. And that was his scheme, really, was to kind of transform from the Yankee merchant of his youth and the Continental general of his middle years into the plantation owner, the planter. And he had started doing that. Like a lot of people that get into farming, he wasn't very successful off the bat. He made quite a few mistakes going forward. And then he died tragically. So who knows? He may have been able to make this transformation into kind of the low country planter life, but he never really had the opportunity to.
Well, there's some interesting sidelights to what happens after the war, because the feud between Greene and Sumter continues. Some things you can't prove. Sumter was trying to develop a new state capitalist, Statesboro. Mm-hmm. He was going to make a fortune. Well, he didn't have the clout, and he had ticked off some people in the General Assembly, so that didn't happen. But he was named commissioner of to lay out the streets of the capital, and streets running north-south were named for officers of the Continental Line, and those running east-west for local militia.
Uh-huh.
And guess whose name didn't appear?
I bet it was Nathaniel Greene.
It was Nathaniel Greene. Granny Gates got a street. Benjamin Lincoln, who lost Charleston, got a street, but not Nathaniel Greene. Nathaniel Greene did get a street officially during the American Revolution bicentennial when the city of Columbia, there was a street without an E, and it was very clear it had not been named for Nathanael Greene, and the E was added. And so it was officially said that Columbia now did have a street named for Nathanael Greene.
Well, I talk about it in the book. Sumter did not kind of make the indiscretion of putting his negative feelings about Greene on paper. The same is not true. Yeah. Greene did write some negative things about Sumter, and eventually some of those things ended up in the public being published in some of the accounts of the war, and Sumter was upset about that.
And he actually tried to block the bill that was going to give Mrs. Greene the financial relief. That was one thing I thought, you know, Sumter, you should have been a bigger man than that.
That was when I read that, I thought, okay, this is the perfect close to the book, because you've gone through this incredible military campaign where you've really essentially ended the war, and now you've got this kind of final conflict between Thomas Sumter, who is now a U.S. congressman from South Carolina, and has the opportunity to vote on this reimbursement, which was really kind of the albatross around Greene's neck the final years of his life. And they say Sumter in his political career didn't really get up on the floor and talk much as a U.S. congressman or senator. But in this case, he got up and spoke against Nathanael Greene.
And that really ticked off a lot of other Revolutionary War figures in South Carolina. I mean, but then that was Thomas Sumter. Andrew, we need to pause for a moment.
Okay.
Let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Andrew Waters about his book, The Quaker and the Gamecock, and we're discussing the revolution in the backcountry. The one thing that, and you have a chapter devoted to this, Sumter's Law.
Yes.
How about explaining that to our listeners?
Yes, and I'd like to start by just saying how influential Partisans and Redcoats was on the way that I thought about this topic and read about this topic. So as you know, as you point out in your book, this was a period when slave ownership was really becoming a mark of class distinction in the backcountry. And there was starting to be a dividing line between haves and have-nots. And in most cases, the haves had owned slaves. And so we get into this this campaign in 1781, and Greene has come back to South Carolina, and he's begging Sumter and Marion and many others for troops. And the problem is that the militia troops, the volunteer troops that are being supplied by Sumter and Marion and Pickens, really haven't made any commitment. They're serving as volunteers, and they're only agreeing to stay on for a period of weeks. And of course, it's very difficult to run a war that way. You need troops who are committed, who are enlisted. And Greene was imploring Sumter to deliver him these troops. And Sumter came up with this idea of a way to recruit and enlist what he called state troops. These were troops that were committed for at least a year. And his idea was to pay these troops in part through captured slaves. And this is what has come to be known as Sumter's Law. It was this policy that Sumter instituted with these state troops, saying, okay, if you serve with me for 10 months or a year, I will pay you in slaves that we capture through our campaigning.
From Tories.
That's correct. They did make the distinction that the slaves would be captured from Loyalists and the slaves wouldn't be captured from the Whigs or the Patriots. But of course, it wasn't always easy to tell what belonged to who.
Who belonged to who, which side.
Right.
People changed a lot. But this became an issue in the legislature after the war for Sumter, because he was being sued by people. And it took a while before the General Assembly finally cleared him of this. I mean, he didn't happen immediately after the war. And I think part of the rancor that kind of surrounded the guy post-war.
Yes, I agree with that completely. This was an issue that he dealt with for several years after the war. It was, you know, when he was doing it in the spring of 1781, he was essentially doing it in a vacuum. I mean, there was there really wasn't kind of a political process in place. But as soon as order was restored, it did become very controversial for him, and there were quite a few, as you can imagine, quite a few Whig slave owners or people who were politically influenced by Whig slave owners who were very threatened by this policy. They didn't like the idea of anyone capturing anybody's slaves.
Yeah, in fact, there was that was capital punishment in colonial South Carolina. It was to steal somebody else's mm-hmm. slave. So eventually, this Sumter, he and Rutledge had a set to over this. Governor Rutledge had a set to over the question of Sumter's law. So it was, as you say, it was not particularly popular. It did enable him to keep his troops together for 10 months. But one of his critics wasn't just Nathaniel Greene. Francis Marion mm-hmm. was very critical of Sumter and his law.
Yes, I think in this whole Sumter's law issue, at least in as far as our modern day values and perspective, it's really Marion who kind of emerges with kind of his integrity intact on this issue. He was very opposed to Sumter's law. I don't know much about his personal life, but he was a man of great integrity, and Sumter's law really bothered him.
Yeah. Although there were some backcountry families whose, I don't want to say fortunes, but whose eventual success would be based upon having benefited from Sumter's law.
Well, as I learned from your book, Walter, that this was really kind of the dividing line between kind of being a successful backcountry planter or not being. Yeah. And if you had slaves, you were able to do much better.
Well, and of course, actually, the British had no compunctions at all about mm-hmm. stealing slaves. How do you think a British officer was advanced for promotion? You mm-hmm. had to buy it. Well, mm-hmm. if you capture slaves, it can happen. Mm-hmm. 25% of South Carolina's enslaved population disappeared during the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty incredible. We're mm-hmm. talking about probably 25,000. Some did leave with loyalists when Charleston was evacuated. The rest were captured off as booty of war. Some were killed.
Mm-hmm. So I think, Greene really didn't have a big issue with Sumter's law when Sumter was instituting it. But as this kind of personality conflict between them progressed, he was kind of using it to gain leverage or political power over Sumter, this issue.
Yeah, and you mentioned the personalities, and I think – and the fact that Greene wrote things down. Sumter didn't always write things down. We know how he – some of the things he said or did in the legislature. But Greene's background, he was very prim and proper.
Mm-hmm.
He was – maybe that's the Quaker influence, mm-hmm. or just simply being a New Englander. And he was very – in his own way, he was very frank, even on paper, which isn't always wise. He was critical of other militia leaders as well, but he seems to have been really hard on Sumter.
Yes, I think in my opinion, when Greene returned to South Carolina and was deciding to attack Camden, which was the main outpost in the central part of the state and fortified, garrisoned by the British, he was in communication with Sumter, and he was, imploring Sumter, "I need your help. I need your troops. I need your supplies." And Sumter was responding positively to that. He was saying, okay, I'm going to do what I can. I'm going to help you. And then Greene gets to the outskirts of Camden, where he eventually fights the Battle of Harbkirk's Hill. And he kind of writes Sumter and says, okay, Gamecock, I'm here now. Come help. And Sumter never shows up. So I think this was a big moment in their relationship and really kind of created the dynamic that you referred to, where there really wasn't trust after that point.
And in the world of the 18th century world, but particularly in the Civil War in South Carolina, trust was all important.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's a marvelous quote from some unknown and anonymous backcountryman, as you never knew whether your brother or your uncle or your dad was going to be on the other side, mm-hmm. that the only thing you could really trust was your rifle.
Mm-hmm. And Greene was in a position where he had no other options. So he was, you know, he had this troublesome relationship, a business relationship in a certain way, and he needed to maintain that relationship with the Gamecock, with Sumter, to move forward. So this is where you get Greene kind of being very deferential and respectful to Sumter in his communications, but also making some comments behind Sumter's back that aren't quite as complimentary.
You're being kind. Okay. Andrew, why don't we, you know, sum all this up.
Okay.
We've got a few minutes left.
Okay.
Your views on the revolution in the backcountry.
Uh-huh.
You've used the term civil war. You want to expound on that?
Well, that was the big revelation to me when I moved to Spartanburg and started learning about the American Revolution here in South Carolina. It was a revolution. We were fighting for our freedom from England. But it was also very much a civil war here. And I think there's a line from Lyman Draper, and he talks about the different types of people who were loyalists and sided with the crown. But he says the most influential reason was your clan or your leader. And that was really – it was really a clan versus a clan, and where you lay on the issue of America versus Britain really depended on where the people who you were affiliated with lay on the issue. And so there were factions. There were people fighting one another within the same community. And it really, as Charleston fell and the British took over, it really got quite vicious, and there was a lot of atrocities on both sides. And I think that part of the book is my perspective, and Greene's perspective is the same, because he was quite shocked by this, and I was learning about it. I was shocked as well.
People have often talked about how Hollywood portrays the revolution, and I don't want to get too much into that, but they say, oh, it was horrible. This couldn't be this bad, whether it was how the British treated the Americans or how the Americans treated one another. And I've often said, if a movie were made depicting the revolution in the backcountry as it actually happened, it could never get a rating.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when, I mean, for example, Francis Marion's nephew was captured and a shotgun put to his chest and he was blown apart because he was captured as a prisoner and because he was Marion's nephew? I mean, that's pretty brutal. I mean, there are lots of other examples. One time where Sumter did something that was very out of character, and this is very positive. He had captured James Weems.
Mm.
And Weems had on his person a list of all the plantations and farms that they had visited and destroyed. Had Sumter let that out, his men would have killed Weems on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Sumter destroyed that document.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's totally out of character with Sumter. Sumter didn't mind taking prisoners and not asking questions about what happened mm-hmm. to him. Marion had a thing of he didn't You know, he would take prisoners. Sumter preferred not to take prisoners. And that incident, that British officer would have been dead meat had he revealed that to his troops.
Yeah, so I think that for me, that's what's so fascinating about this story is, you know, these were both incredible men. I mean, they were very different men, but they, during this period, they led incredible lives, and they were both very instrumental to this effort to really push the British out of the interior of South Carolina and really win the war.
And, of course, as we all know, that's why the American Revolution was won.
I could not agree with you more, Walter.
Andrew Waters, author of The Quaker and the Gamecock. Thanks for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's show. Andrew Waters' book, The Quaker and the Gamecock, is a fascinating study of two of the key personalities involved in the revolution in the South Carolina backcountry. And the title itself reflects those personalities, Nathanael Greene, prim and proper New Englander, and the Gamecock, impetuous backcountry entrepreneur Thomas Sumter. An interesting chapter in South Carolina history. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.